I work under the logo of Zero Point Institute for Mystical and Spiritual Science. Often people hear that phrase and they think, oh, aren't mysticism and science opposed to each other? And what do I mean by an institute for mystical and spiritual science? And there's really various aspects to that, but on the one side, I'm attempting through my work to understand the possible scientific merit and validity of mystical teachings. And throughout history, we've had all different esoteric and mystical teachings. So I'm interested in examining them to understand what the mystics claim about the nature of self, about the nature of existence, about higher states of consciousness, about how a person might know God or have spiritual realizations. So I'm interested in mystical ideas and how these might be understood within the scientific perspective. So not simply to accept mystical or religious ideas on the basis of belief, but to understand the scientific validity or invalidity of mystical teachings. And the second aspect of the Institute for Mystical and Spiritual Science is to look at the theories and findings of modern science itself and interpret them from a mystical perspective, or to provide a mystical perspective on the interpretations of the facts and theories of modern science. And I think the typical or prototypical example of this is the modern concept in physics of vacuum genesis, which it means in modern terms creation out of the quantum vacuum or out of a realm of nothingness, and the modern scientific idea that the universe emerged from a point source called the singularity, actually estimated at 10 to the minus 33 centimeters in diameter. So physicists have this notion of our universe emerging from a point source out of an apparent nothingness. Now, whereas modern physicists have formulated this concept of the origin of the universe within the last 20 years, actually this concept is an ancient, it verifies an ancient valid mystical claim about the origin of the universe from a point source. And it's one of the key concepts in Blavatsky's Secret Doctrine, published in 1888. The concept of the point source origin of the universe is also found in Kabbalah, as well as in Vedic teachings and other esoteric sources. So the modern concept of vacuum genesis and of modern idea of singularities, these ideas do not disprove ancient mystical and spiritual teachings, but actually they confirm or support the mystical claims. So the second side then of our studies is to look at modern scientific ideas having a mystical perspective and try to interpret those theories or view them in a different light. Because the interpretation of the facts of science, see, the same facts of science might be interpreted from different perspectives. And if we have a mystical perspective, then we can bring that to bear on modern concepts. So when we hear about vacuum genesis and singularities, we don't automatically think, oh, how science has advanced, and now there's less and less for God to do because now we have modern science. Now we believe the universe emerged out of the nothingness of the quantum vacuum. Okay, whereas in reality, that concept is even in the first three verses of the book of Genesis, where it says, in the beginning God created the heaven and the earth was empty and void, suggesting a period of pre-existence where nothing existed, that the earth was unmanifest, material nature was unmanifest. So the idea of vacuum genesis isn't something inconsistent with the first verses of Genesis. And in fact, the ideas about creation out of nothingness are pervasive within the mystical literature. In Kabbalah and Vedic teachings and Tibetan Buddhism and Chinese philosophies and so on. So this two-hour show is dedicated to trying to explain mystical and esoteric teachings and relate them to modern psychology and science. I thank BBS Radio so much for having the opportunity to provide these shows, and I'm in the fifth year of the shows on BBS. And there's a wealth of material in the archives. Okay, I'd like to bring on my co-host, James Moffat. I'm from just south of Ottawa, Ontario, Canada, and Jim's in Toronto. Jim, how are you?
Good. How are you, Chris?
Yeah, good.
That was a nice introduction. I think a little bit different way of approaching things, but, you know, right on the
yeah,
money.
I try to vary every time a little bit to express things differently. It's interesting how mystical teachings are so organic, like how your understanding of them changes and evolves so much over time. And you understand the same concept, but at different times you understand it more and more deeply. And in a way, things get simpler and simpler. They get complex in the beginning, but then they get simpler.
Well, I don't know if they get simpler. I think they get more coherent and more lucid.
Yeah,
but as you say, it's funny because I was writing about this very thing in connection with our history with the Fourth Way when we first started studying it. And Uspensky at one point says of the system of the Fourth Way teaching that the more he worked with it and the more he studied himself and the world in terms of it, it seemed that the teachings, rather than just being a set of ideas, felt like it was something organic and something that was alive and informing him. And I said that basically we had exactly the same experience. And I don't expect most people, when they read that, are going to understand that or going to believe that. But it's very peculiar. When Gurdjieff said one point that in terms of his teaching that it was possible to understand everything to understand something about oneself, but in order to understand something, one had to understand everything. And in a way, like that's what his teaching is like too. It all of the parts are in the whole, and all of the whole is in the parts. And like that holographic analogy is like, the more you work at it, the more you develop that coherent source of illumination, and each of the parts becomes more and more focused and gives a broader and more comprehensive understanding of the whole. So, in a sense, as you say, it gets very complex at first, then it gets simpler in a sense, but not simpler, but more lucid and more coherent. So it is simpler in a sense, but it's more complex in terms of your application and in terms of your comprehension of so many things. And I guess, like, for me, having studied various philosophies and psychologies and different sets of ideas, I'd never come across anything where things got simultaneously, you could study the things at a lower and lower level, like more intensely any part, and at the same time, things became more comprehensive. Like the parts became more coherent, but the application became more comprehensive. I think that's quite unique to esoteric teachings. I don't know of any other set of ideas if that's true of, because I think generally with ideas, when you focus on the parts, on smaller and smaller parts of things, you lose the more comprehensive picture, and you don't get the application. But it's precisely the opposite in terms of esoteric teachings.
Yeah, that reminds me of how I sometimes call science little bit science, because so much of regular science, it's everybody becomes a specialist within a subdivision of a particular discipline. And they study a smaller and smaller bit, but out of relationship to the whole.
Yeah.
And corresponds in a way. It's like mystical philosophy kind of gives you a perspective of the whole in which to try to integrate those different bits. And it strikes me how it's interesting, if you have a mystical perspective, you can apply that to different areas of study. Like, it's pertinent to the study of modern physics and chemistry, and it's pertinent to the study of biology, and it's pertinent to the study of evolutionary theory, and of psychology, and of sociology, and of astronomy. Like, with a mystical perspective, you know, there's something distinctive about it, that it gives you a different perspective on these different areas of science. And it's a fascinating life study, and this has kind of culminated. I have in front of me a trade paperback edition of my newest book, which I'm trying to get ready for publication. It's called God, Science, and the Secret Doctrine. And I'm absolutely thrilled to have this edition. I sent one off to you by mail this morning, Jim.
Oh, okay, great.
I the lady who's setting it up, Alice, she's on holiday for 10 days, so I have till the end of August to try. I want to come up with whatever edits, and there's some formatting difficulties in it and such a bit, but not a lot. I'm working my way through it, and so I'm hoping once she gets back, I think she'd be able to do the edits in a day, and I hope within the month that this will be available for sale.
Wow.
It's an absolutely beautiful book. I thought the cover of The Heart Doctrine was nice. This is even nicer, eh?
I like the cover. It's the same cover that you were using before.
Yeah, I think I sent you a PDF file of it, eh?
Yeah, I like it. It's very attractive.
It's nice having black covers on my book. I like that a lot, and it highlights the pictures, makes them very attractive. So it's so interesting to see my own work in trade paperback format, and reading it is different than, in a way, reading my 8.5 by 11 notes or Sherlock binding books. It gives a whole distance to it. It's interesting. It's a pleasure reading parts of this. So I'm very, very pleased with this, and it forms such a complementary copy. Like, The Heart Doctrine is about the mysteries of human existence and the origins of consciousness. And then this book complements that because its focus is on the mysteries of creation and the mysteries of the universe or cosmos. So one is on human existence, and the other is on the existence of the cosmos and life and such. So they really complement each other as works. So I thought today, I sent one off in the mail to you. I want to thank you, Jim, for your donation to Zero Point. It reminded me to, if there are any listeners out there, I'm a private, independent individual who tries to do these studies on mystical teachings, and I work at my books and my website, and I get about 300 people a day at the moment to my website. And I think sometimes, oh, that's really cool. 300 people a day around the world are reading some of the perspective I'm presenting there. So I work on my website and my writing, and then BBS, this radio show. So if there's anyone out there who is supportive of my work, I would appreciate donations. And you can see that how to donate would be from my own website at www.zeropoint.ca. And I think there's a donation button through BBS. Okay, so Jim, I thought, why don't we try to get back to going through some of the Blavatsky, and we might kind of pursue this over a couple shows, and by next week you'll have your copy of this book, because it'll be there in 2 business days, so you'll get it at the latest Tuesday.
Yeah, it's interesting because right now in the book that I'm writing, The Problem of God's Contracting Universe, which is about Christopher's work and my perspective on it, and sort of in some ways is a attempt to trace the development of his model of consciousness and various aspects of the model that he puts forth. I got to a certain point where I had introduced your work, and then I went off and I talked about some other things in subsequent chapters about the history of Western psychology and science and how they've defined consciousness and some of the mistakes that from a mystical or esoteric perspective that they've made. And I spent a fair amount of time talking about how this is part of Chris's work about the head doctrine, about how people are sort of oriented through their heads and attribute consciousness to that which emerges out of the head brain. But I realized when I went back and I was working on the book that I needed another chapter to expand, Chris, on just the basic presentation, because I talked a little bit about, I talked quite a bit about Gurdjieff and basic ideas from Gurdjieff about how we're multi-brain beings and that we live in a multi-dimensional universe, because it seems to me like that's the foundation of everything that comes from in your work, comes from that, and explain various ideas about how we're not properly conscious. And then I got into the presentation of the heart doctrine, and then also some basic ideas about zero points from Blavatsky's The Secret Doctrine and the mystery of light and material on that. But I realized I needed one more chapter, so I'm kind of, I read through the Heart Doctrine again. I've read it twice this year, and I realized, well, now I have to go through God, Science, and the Secret Doctrine to get a little bit more. It's like it's not what to say. The question of what to say is kind of, I'm trying to boil it down to its essential elements, and I'm a little bit stuck in terms of, like, I don't want it to get too complicated, but at the same time I want to, you know, I'm going to come back and discuss things at the end of the book a little bit further, but I want to give some of the extraordinary sense of, like, how you develop the metaphysical dimensions with relation to the heart and to creation and the parallels between the zimzum contraction and the vacated heart space, which I think is really essential. I think that's such an important idea and something that I don't think I've ever really seen in any kind of contemporary discussion of consciousness in anybody's model. I think that's quite unique to your work. I think that's really fascinating. So that's kind of where
it's funny
where I am.
I was going to just say, it's funny how the one place you have that concept a bit is in Jean-Paul Sartre's philosophy, existential philosophy, the way he talks about nothing, about there being nothingness at the heart of being.
Yeah.
And how that consciousness, he says, is this kind of form of nothingness. Like he says, you're always conscious of something. The consciousness involves intentionality, like you're conscious of some object of consciousness. But that consciousness itself is this nothingness.
Yeah.
It's this nothingness which allows you to be aware of all the different things.
Yeah.
So it's like there's that enigma of what human existence is. It's like there's that nothingness at the heart of being. And Sartre is very brilliant kind of ontology and kind of philosophy of consciousness in his work that takes on a whole new significance again if you have a mystical perspective, and then, as you say, you can relate it in Kabbalah to the zimzum contraction, whereby God, the infinite being, vacates a space within the human heart, and that's a lot to allow an independent finite being to come into existence, because if God didn't vacate some space, well, then everything's swallowed up in the infinite. So to be able to allow individual life, he had to vacate the space, and that's the zimzum contraction. And in the mystical teachings, that's why human beings are said to have remembrance of God, and we're trying to fill this emptiness within the heart, and people can try to fill that emptiness. You can attempt to fill it through material things or status or power or sexuality and different experiences. But the fundamental enigma of human existence is this nothingness at the heart of being. It's all so beautiful. There's a certain, such a poetry to mystical concepts.
Yeah, well, a couple of things come to mind immediately. Like, as you say, that's what I guess in reading this work and in the way that you've developed it, the thing that strikes me about it, and always has struck me about esoteric and mystical thought, is how elegant it is. And it's so odd how it's misrepresented by so many people and misunderstood, that when you really get into these ideas and start to explore them, you realize that they're incredibly lucid and elegant, and the explanation, I mean, it's so coherent. Like, I mean, and there's these parallels, and as I've talked about in previous programs, it's interesting how to referring to what you said before, like certain ideas take on an entirely different meaning as you progress, and you see the incredible brilliance and profundity of some of the esoteric maxims, like as above, so below, or the microcosm is the microcosm of the macrocosm. You see how much is embodied in that. The more you understand mystical and esoteric teachings, the more you see how profound those statements are. The other thing which I was just going to comment on is how odd, that I think about 1969 or 70, when you were an undergraduate, you started to study existentialism, and I remember that was all you sort of talked about a year, was that you existentialism and phenomenology, and used to come over to my house after you're visiting your girlfriend up the street, and who was my neighbor, and you'd come over, and we'd sit in the basement, and you and my brother Doug and I, and we'd talk about existentialism, and you sort of gave this whole sort of series of impromptu lectures on existentialism phenomenology, which was quite fascinating, you know. And I remember my brother Doug saying, like, boy, it's like, you know, it's like getting a college education. I'm not even in college, you know. Yeah, so it's so interesting that, as you say, like, you can go back to Sartre and you can see that he's touched on something really significant, although from a different perspective, and he doesn't embrace the mystical aspect of that. But it's like, it's so fascinating that he has such insight into things. And
and introduced a very valuable language for talking about consciousness in a way. How he gives it like a different ontological status than the existence of material things, because consciousness is this kind of thing which is no thing, and this thing which is everything but what it is. It's fascinating.
It's kind of like with the mystery of consciousness. The thing is that really it's beyond our verbal analytical capacities to properly describe it, so we have to describe its reflection in a sense, and we have to kind of attribute, like, you can't properly describe it in a sense, and its fullness and its otherness is beyond sort of our normal language
And how our understanding, like the development of wisdom, like it takes a certain knowledge, experience of knowledge, and then an experience in being of direct experience, and those complement each other to develop understanding. Understanding requires that development in knowledge and in being. And so these things that you understand it on one level, but then you have further experience and additional knowledge, and you understand it more deeply. And that's a concept like the zero point concept. I mean, I'm still struggling to understand that. And I had an interesting email the other day, this fellow in Europe, and I'd like to read a little bit of this. It's interesting because he says some things which are so profound, trying to describe some zero-point dynamics. And it kind of made me realize, it's like we're trying to develop a language for something that is unfamiliar to us. Like zero-point itself, that concept is unfamiliar to people. And to be able to talk about what I'm trying to get at in terms of zero point dynamics and the higher dimensions of the human heart, things like that. It's like we don't have a language. We've not been prepared for that. And he introduces some phrases which are really valuable here. I don't want to read the whole thing because it's a bit long. I'm going to post some of these comments up on my website and respond to it and elaborate upon it a bit. Okay, he's saying, he begins, I find Marco Rodin interesting for two reasons. His map, Fingerprint of God, Sacred Geometry, demonstrates what Tesla says about, if you understand the 3, 6, and 9, then you will have a key to the universe. I didn't know Tesla said that, eh, Jim? That's interesting.
No, that's very interesting.
Yeah, the 3, the 6, and the 9. I think of it in terms of the Enneagram.
That's
the
exactly
three,
what
six,
the reaction I, the 3 points in the Enneagram is like, wow.
Yeah, huh. And I think that's what Marco Rodin works with, is the Enneagram. Eh?
Okay.
Yeah. And his work shows that zero does not exist, or more properly, zero is a dimensional vortex.
Oh, yeah.
Now, this is a very valuable term.
Yeah,
like,
yeah,
it's a dimensional vortex, because this is what I'm saying is like the higher dimensional physics of the human heart, that it's this kind of dimensional vortex. He goes on, my belief is that the zero point in any zero point field is a dimensional vortex, and his work simply provides a tool for understanding that which isn't available in the normal zero-point literature.
Oh.
Okay, so I'm going to look into his work more. But then I skip a little bit here. And in my opinion, he starts talking about the lineage of Tesla, John Keeley. Keeley was an inventor in Blavatsky's day who was trying to develop a machine that ran on perpetual energy. And Blavatsky supported Keeley's work and encouraged it and saw the base there being a basis for it. And then the lineage of Tesla, John Keeley, then Edward Leeds Skalnin, who I've never heard of, and those interested in harnessing radiant energy. Keeley developed a machine to capture free energy, which he could control with his mind and could teach others how to do so too. There is a researcher called Dr. Pond who has done a lot of work in this area. It was interesting, a few years back, Jim, I went to Montreal for this demonstration by this fellow who had these complex electrical circuit boards which he seemingly could control just through his mind and intention and turn them off. It was an absolutely fascinating lecture. Unfortunately, it was in French, so it made it difficult to understand it. I never grokked or, I lost contact with that individual, but apparently Keeley could do that same thing, apparently control some of his motives with his mind. It's my opinion Keeley was vibrating with love to do that, which is why Blavatsky was interested in him. I think this is also what the King's Chamber in the Great Pyramid is for. It is a technology designed to increase meditational awareness of love, which gets stronger the closer you get to the center of the zero-point vortex. The physics of the chamber gets you into a higher state of consciousness.
Huh.
So this is really profound what he says about the meditational awareness of love gets stronger the closer you get to the center of the zero-point vortex.
Wow.
That's really profound because it's like as you merge into the zero-point, in a way it's like you're returning into the bosom of the Divine Mother.
Yeah.
Yeah, because in mystical teachings, it's like creation emerges out of the Divine Mother. And Blavatsky says the suns, meaning universes, expand and contract through their own hearts and selves. Okay, so in the beginning of time, an individual is thought to kind of emerge out of the Divine Mother and expand within without, like the budding of a lotus. And eventually the life principles withdraw again without within back to a point and back into the bosom of the Divine Mother. And the idea that, the mother in the end of time, the Divine Mother ingathers all her sons to her bosom. So the closer you are to the center of the zero point center, then you become filled with this like infinite cosmic love of the Divine Mother, which is like a pervasive element within space or within the cosmos. So I thought that was very a profound idea that I just never formulated it in that way. Like the meditational awareness of love gets stronger the closer you get to the center of the zero-point vortex.
Well, it's so consistent with the whole idea, too, that, you know, when people have experiences like in near-death experiences or often different types of mystical experiences where they're conscious in these higher dimensions and they encounter these beings of light, these monads, from higher dimensional monads, and they always talk about the feelings of love that radiated, you know? So, I mean, that would be entirely consistent. Eh? Like the higher you go, the more love there is. I mean, and it's entirely consistent with, like, Yogananda's, you know, cosmic consciousness where he talks about the bliss, you know? Like, I mean, on some level, we are all rooted into this bliss, but we're so far from it because we're tied up in the knots of the heart. I mean, it's entirely consistent, but that's very, very profound, as you say. I like that.
Okay, so then he goes on, he writes, "The heart is literally what keeps us anchored to and in this 3D realm and gives us time and feeling. The heart is the way that we experience the fourth dimension. In a sense, it is what projects us here."
Wow.
And that's really interesting. See, that's beautiful.
Yeah.
That's kind of what I'm trying to get at in my work, is that our individual experience in this life is kind of projected out of higher dimensions.
It's like we're squeezed, like the worlds are squeezed out of zero points. We're kind of projected out of these higher dimensions. Like, that's so
yeah.
perfect. Yeah.
Yeah. And the zero-point center is like a vortex. Like, you know, in my book, I use the image of the light cone, which
right.
is like a cone above that comes to a point and then a cone below, and that's
okay.
called a light cone.
Yeah.
And I use that to illustrate the zero-point concept, that the zero-point is like a transitional point between the metaphysical world above and the material world below. And that's what Blavatsky's saying in The Secret Doctrine, is she says, quote, "The gods and other," no, she says, "material points without extension," which I would say is a zero point, okay, a point without extension, "are the materials by which the gods and other invisible powers clothe themselves in bodies." So what that suggests is that all living beings have this kind of zero-point center, and that is a vortex or that through which higher-dimensional forces well up within without and infuse or inform a human life and human existence. Okay, so he goes on, "We are heart projections emanating from individual zero-point fields, which individually connect to the underlying multidimensional lattice. The question which arises is, what is on the other side of the vortex and projecting? My belief is that nothingness is unity. The vortex, the vibration of love, leads to unity and cohesion. Is it that multidimensional aspect of ourselves which are doing the projecting? What I mean is, our multidimensional self chose this incarnation, heart projection, and through our lifetime, while one part of ourself is grounded here, the others are joined, all joined through the heart." So it gives, it's very nice, like, giving the idea that this life is this kind of heart projection out of this multidimensional heart. It's a valuable image.
Yeah. Wow.
So he goes on, "So I am saying that the heart is a zero-point field which leads neither to death or to the fourth dimension. My opinion is that spirit is connected through the heart to the multidimensional superstructure. Five dimension and up. The heart leads to all dimensions. This is what is through the spiral." So that's a beautiful image of the heart. It's the heart is like as I say, the heart is not simply the physical heart, but there's like a physical heart, a psychical heart, a spiritual heart, and ultimately there's said to be a divine source emanation, like a God spark. And that's at the ultimate kind of higher dimensional physics of the human heart, is a God spark. And then that's embodied into a spiritual heart, a psychical heart, and a material heart. And the heart is what kind of connects those all those levels of a human being together. It's through the heart that a human being is ensouled by spirit. So you have the body, soul, and spirit. So we are ensouled through the zero point physics of the heart.
Sure.
Okay, I'm almost done with these. A little bit more here. When we increase the capacity of our hearts to love and increase our rate of vibration, we get centered to closer to the center of the zero-point field. The closer to zero-point we get, the more all opposites and polarities are becoming one. That's really nice, because you see how much in mystical teachings the matrix of creation is made manifest through dualistic opposing principles. And you see this on the tree of life in Kabbalistic teachings. You have the central column, which obviously goes down the center, and then you have a pillar on the right and left side representing the masculine and feminine forces in nature. And the idea in Kabbalah is, if you can balance these opposing forces on any level of the tree and bring them into relationship and balance them, then that dissipates. The structures maintained by that dissipates. So the individual ascends the tree of life through the central column, through balancing and neutralizing the opposing forces within them. And that kind of, so everything adds up to zero, and the soul kind of ascends through the central pillar.
Wow.
Yeah, that's called climbing the ladder of Jacob.
Yeah. Wow, what a beautiful, integration of scientific and mystical ideas. I like the idea of dissipative structures leading to reconstitution on a higher level or more complex level. But I especially like the part where it all adds up to zero. I really like that, So interesting. And again, like you say, coming back to this idea that the nothingness at the heart of being, which is really, really quite profound. It's just like it's so difficult to even think about it in a way, but the more you kind of mull it over and try to work with it, the more real it becomes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. So this place near to the zero point in the imploding spiral of the heart is love, and it is here that we can perceive manifestation. This is only what I believe and where I have got to through meditation and some work with a group of beings from the Arcturus system. I'm not really sure what that is. Anyway, so those were the main comments. But it's interesting. I thought some of his descriptive phrases here were very valuable. Like it was perfectly in accord with things I would say, but the way he phrased it, it is very valuable. I'm going to kind of post some of these on my website.
Was he responding to your website, or had he read your book?
Yeah, he just come across my website, and he does zero-point meditations, he calls it.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Wow. How interesting. Yeah. What is his, does he talk about what he is, like his background? Or?
No, he doesn't really know. No, other than being born in England, and I think he said he's in Belgium or Netherlands at the moment.
Okay.
Yeah.
Wow, very interesting.
Yeah, you see the kind of convergence, like people around the world are coming to that zero-point concepts from different angles a bit, like you have it in physics and people talking about zero-point energies. But actually, very few people consider the concept that a human being has a zero-point center. Like, I'm not sure who else I know of in the literature who really articulates that position, that a human being has zero point center related to the human heart.
I think
Dan Winters may. I'm not sure. He's...
Oh, well, yeah. I don't think there's a lot of people out there. I think that's quite unique about your work. And relating it to the heart, too, is, I think, is the other thing, you know, is that I don't know. I don't know of these other people who might write about it, but I would imagine that people would be talking about their brains, you know, like, and not about the heart. And the idea of the higher dimensional aspects of the heart, higher dimensional physics of the heart, is very, very profound, I think, you know, and really quite unique. At the very least, like, what's so interesting about this entire perspective is that it provides an entirely plausible, well, let's put it this way, which, when you compare it to the really, like, the huge gaps in contemporary knowledge of the materialist perspective, like, we really can't explain the arising of consciousness or life or the creation of the universe, and I don't count the explanations that this something happened accidentally, and or that, you know, there is no explanation of how matter gained life, and there is no real explanation of how we are conscious. I mean, it, other than to suggest that it comes from the brain, but that's just not, you know, there's no evidence for that. So the idea is that in this perspective is that it provides a very plausible, I think, alternative explanation for everything, because life and consciousness are basic, and they're just there, and they're stepped down, or we're projections from these higher dimensions, and life is a projection from, and consciousness are projections from these higher dimensions and informed by these higher dimensions. To me, it makes total sense, and not just on that level, but when considering it in terms of all the other anomalies and mysteries and enigmas regarding consciousness, with, like, higher types of conscious experience and the psychical phenomena and the explanations given in the esoteric teachings, it all seems to be quite consistent and congruent with this radically different perspective. That's what I say. It's very elegant. There's nothing in this. There's lots of things in this I don't understand, you know, we're so far beyond me. But at the same time, like, the basic elements seem to me to be entirely plausible and reasonable, and I think it's worthwhile examining for sure. I mean, you know, this is like,
yeah, you see how it's not inconsistent with known scientific facts or theories. Like, there's nothing that contradicts it. And yet it could explain and help us understand a lot of other phenomena that scientists normally just close their eyes to.
Yeah.
Like the basic enigma of, say, I mean, this is where we were 30 years ago when we discussed out-of-body experiences. We both had different out-of-body experiences and shared that. Now, that is so profound, because if our own inner experiences are correct, and it seems to ourselves that we're out of our bodies, and yet we're still conscious, sensing, aware, like individual identity, like you can still think. So you're out of your body, and you feel almost completely yourself.
Yeah.
Now, that is so enigmatic, because that suggests if you can be outside of your body and feel almost completely yourself, what it suggests is that it wasn't your body which had produced that inner self experience.
Yeah.
It wasn't out of the matter of the brain and neurology of the brain that produced that experience. Instead, you are something that inhabits the body, and the body is a vehicle or sheath or form for the self to inhabit. This, like, goes back to what I was saying about Institute for Mystical and Spiritual Science, because I could see in ways how those people in the main materialists who kind of dismiss all the evidences for out-of-body experiences, near-death experiences, ghosts, ESP, all these psychical phenomena. In a way, those people don't at all embody the scientific attitude.
Yeah.
Instead, they have rigid prejudices, which and they prejudge material. They it's like Roger Sperry says, I don't see any way for a functioning, for consciousness to exist apart from a functioning brain. He says that. But at the same time, in his writings on consciousness, he is never able to explain how consciousness is produced by a functioning brain.
Yeah.
Like he says, I can't see how consciousness can exist apart from the brain, but he also can't explain how it's produced by the brain. But he doesn't see that as a problem. He just assumes it has to be produced by the brain.
Well, I remember reading, an article by John Searle, a contemporary philosopher of consciousness, in the New York Review of Books, and he was talking about he was reviewing somebody's book, I believe it must have been, and he was talking, and there was a couple of passages where he was very frank, and I thought really, you know, very forthright and very accurate about the lack of contemporary understanding of consciousness, and you know, I thought, well, wow, that's really good. And then I'm reading his interview with Susan Blackmore and conversations on her book Conversations on Consciousness, and he says something to the effect that what we do know is that all of our experiences are produced by the brain, every damn one of them. And I'm thinking, and he says the operative word there is explained, and I'm thinking, well, what's the evidence for that? Like, I mean, just because you say something with great conviction and passion doesn't make it true. And I thought, what happened to the guy that was admitting in the New York Review of Books that we really don't know anything about consciousness, you know? And as you say, that's so perfect about Sperry. I was thinking about this the other day about, and again, this is the difference between the perspective that you developed and that we subscribe to it from a mystical and esoteric perspective. Is that, if you assume, as Roger Sperry does, that the universe is this inanimate thing which is composed of matter and energy and has no consciousness and no intelligence to it, then there is no way for consciousness to come from anywhere other than from the brain. At least that's, you know, the brain's obviously, you know, very intimately tied to our conscious experience, so it's a reasonable assumption to think that the brain is producing consciousness if you subscribe to that view of the universe. But if you subscribe to a quite radically different perspective on the universe, then it's not enough. Then there is a way that he can't see. It's all his assumptive framework has limited him in such a way that he can only look at the brain and see that as the only possible source of consciousness. But as I say, if you have the perspective that we have on the universe, then all bets are off. Like, I mean, and I, as I said before, I think it's entirely reasonable to see that these higher dimensional realities are informing and are being stepped down, and that we're projections from the zero points of these higher dimensional realities that are possess consciousness and life, and that's how we're ensouled, and how life arises in the physical body, and how we become identified with the ego and with the physical body. Like, it's an entirely reasonable alternative perspective, but the problem is nobody in modern science recognizes or seems to have any understanding or knowledge of it. It's amazing how ignorant people are of this material.
Yeah, and don't even really consider it as a viewpoint, as a possible viewpoint.
It's it's completely arbitrarily dismissed. I was also thinking, I was, that chapter that I was talking about that I was working on, at the beginning I'm going to do a little detour and I'm going to talk a little bit about Gurdjieff and my kind of depiction of Gurdjieff as being an alien intelligence, and that's like somebody whose level of being is outside of the normal framework for our understanding of consciousness and being, and that he's like a figure. Northrop Frye has a phrase in talking about Jesus in the Gospels, that Jesus is a figure who drops into history from another dimension. And in a way, that's the way I see Gurdjieff. I'm not equating Gurdjieff with Jesus, but anybody who's a higher being of higher consciousness is like a figure from another dimension, and in a way they are figures from another dimension.
Yeah.
And so they are alien intelligences. And then in Gurdjieff's book, Beelzebub's Tales to His Grandson, that's how he tells his story about the history of humankind. He tells it from the perspective of an alien intelligence who's come down and watched human beings throughout history. And so, like, we have this massive discontinuity between people in their normal waking consciousness and these figures who recur throughout history, who show us that higher levels of consciousness and being can be attained by human beings, and that from that perspective, everything that we see is seen as being an illusion in some sense, because we don't see things in their entirety. We don't see them in terms of the higher dimensions that inform everything, and we are subject to all of these illusions, both about ourselves and about the nature of the world, because we have this limited perspective. I forget what I was trying to say.
Has an interesting phrase in Beelzebub's Tales. He talks about sacred individuals actualized from above.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's like where they're brought down into human form, but they're actualized from above.
From above, yeah.
And it's interesting, you know, you watch some of the contemporary movies, like I'm thinking Zeitgeist and The Empire of the City, who do critiques of Christianity. And they point out how so much of the Christian mythology is also repeated in Zoroastrianism, in Egyptian mythology, in Chaldean, in all Zoroaster,
yeah.
That there's so many elements. Mithras, another figure, and many of these figures, like they were born on December 25th,
yeah.
Or they were crucified on the cross, and they were the sons of gods, and so on. And that's usually used to kind of argue the position, well, then that proves that the Christ story was only really adapted from earlier times. But really, it doesn't prove that at all. What it perhaps proves is that different individuals, sacred individuals, might be actualized from above at different times in human history. So, see, it doesn't kind of disprove the Christ story. It's just that maybe Christ wasn't the only one during human history who is somehow actualized from above.
Yeah.
I don't know if you've seen that Zeitgeist movie,
no.
Jim.
No, I've never seen it.
Well, a number of these new movies kind of exposing the New World Order and, with the alternative view of human history have kind of emphasized this. The perspective is to kind of undermine Christianity and raise doubt about the Christ story and simply attribute it to these earlier myths. But I've never heard anyone say, well, perhaps maybe there are different individualized beings, individualized or actualized from above.
Oh, I know what I was going to say, just to finish that thought about Gurdjieff, what I was starting to talk about when I was talking about him as being this alien intelligence, is that, I mean, the idea of an alien intelligence applies to his teaching too, what we were speaking of at the beginning is like when we involved ourselves in the fourth way through trying to study ourselves in the world in terms of that teaching, it was like being in communion with this organic intelligence, so in a way, like that, the teaching was an alien intelligence, and then like a third sense of an alien intelligence is that as you work on yourself, you begin to know yourself in very different ways, and in a sense, you realize that there's this alien intelligence within yourself. Like you are capable of experiencing and knowing and understanding yourself and the world in an entirely different way. Like not just a change, but a transformation. So an understanding on an entirely different level. But what I was going to say about Gurdjieff, and this applies to all esoteric teachings, I was thinking about that I would briefly mention Peter Washington's book, Madame Blavatsky's Baboon, in which he talks about some of the major spiritual figures who appeared at the end of the 19th and the beginning of the 20th century and influenced Westerners, and he talks about Blavatsky, Gurdjieff, Rudolf Steiner, Krishnamurti, primarily. I don't know if there's anybody else, but those are the main figures that he talks about. And the book is book's an interesting book. There's a lot of good stories in it and everything, but it's really an ad hominem attack against all of these figures. And the thing that's most striking about that book is there's not one substantive discussion of any of the teachings or ideas of any of these figures. So.
Yeah.
And I
yeah, it's all like these
hatchet job stories, like, you know, misrepresentations and misconstruing of things, I realized that I was thinking, like, I've never read a discussion of any mystical teaching or esoteric teaching or teacher. I've never read a substantive discussion of any of the ideas, a critical analysis where somebody was able to refute them or even criticize them. I mean, I don't even know of anybody who actually writes about things like that critically. Like, do you know of anybody who's actually...
I don't.
I remember, like, there's a book by Wittol Perry called Gurdjieff and the Light of Tradition, and he's arguing, it's a book critical of Gurdjieff, and he's arguing that that Gurdjieff's a faux teacher because he is a departure from the traditional teachings. And I mean, I think within esoteric studies there are people who, like René Guénon, I think, is another guy who emphasizes the importance of the tradition and that doesn't like, I think he's critical of Gurdjieff too, but I've never read any substantive discussion of, like,
no.
Has anybody ever taken the secret doctrine and said, you know, this is all nonsense, you know, what the hell is this? I mean, I've never read any intelligent discussion of the fourth way that was anything less than neutral. Like, I mean, I it's funny, like, the people that I remember, there's an article in the New York Times. I remember reading one when Meetings with a Remarkable Man, the movie, came out. There's a very good article in the New York Times magazine. There's an article in Horizon magazine, a British publication, many years ago in the 70s. And I've read a few popular accounts. And what always struck me was how respectful the people who wrote the articles were of the teaching. Like, they didn't profess to understand it, or to have studied it, but I've never read anything where people say, well, like, this is
yeah,
wrong.
Well,
I mean,
explain
to me how this is wrong. Like, I'd love to read, you know, somebody critiquing your work. It would be very interesting to, you know, I mean, at the very least, I think you have to acknowledge that, well, I don't know if this is right, but it's not like it's incomprehensible or that it's incoherent or that it's nonsensical. It's none of those things. Like, I mean, it's lucid,
yeah.
It's comprehensive, it's coherent, and it's plausible. That's the thing. If you really admit that we don't know the answers to all these questions, at the very least you have to admit that this is plausible.
Yeah. Yeah, it's, I think, a good example of what you're talking about, and it relates to Washington's book on Blavatsky's Baboon. It is where he refers to Gurdjieff,
yeah,
as fond of threes. Yeah, like Gurdjieff was fond of threes.
Yeah, that's his analysis of Gurdjieff's discussion of the law of three, which I said is a bit like saying that Heisenberg was beset by uncertainty and Einstein was into light. I mean, it's a completely idiotic characterization of what Gurdjieff said about trees.
Yeah, it's so funny because there's that concept, like, there's a mystical concept, is this principle of the law of three. And it goes back, even Pythagoras said, all things consist in three. And you find this idea in the Vedas. There's Brahman manifests as Brahma, Vishnu, and Shiva, the threefoldness of the divine. And in Christianity, God the Father, God the Son, and God the Holy Spirit. And in the Kabbalistic tree, you have three pillars and three supernals. So you find the notion of the triunity of the Godhead, you find that throughout different religions. And then you can take the concept of the law of three And you can apply it in all areas of science. Like you look at psychology, and modern psychology was defined as a science of behavior and the mind in a dualistic way. And then from a mystical perspective, you realize, well, there's head, heart, and hands. We function mentally, emotionally, and physically. So instead of being dualistic, man is triune. And you can find, you know, you look at in physics, and the old physics saw everything in the universe as composed of matter and energy. But now in the new physics, with quantum theory, information is seen as a third force. So there's not just matter and energy, the dual principles, but there's also intelligence or information. So the concept of the law of three, it's not something you can prove, but it's a way of, this is a good example of like a mystical idea that you can use to examine the theories of science.
Yeah.
That gives real insights into the structure of human knowledge, like how we normally always think dualistically, whereas really any time you find a duality, you can always resolve it to a triunity. And it's a very useful heuristic or way of thinking about things.
It's interesting too, as you say, like it's a heuristic to apply to things, to try to understand them in a different way. But it's interesting if you look at the history of behavioristic psychology. Originally, the way it was formulated is that you had stimulus and response, and the way that they wanted to study things scientifically was to look at the externally observable stimulus and the externally observable response. And the idea was that what was happening in between the stimulus and the response was occurring inside the human being and was the black box, as they called it, and so they didn't want anything to do with it and basically just completely ignored it. But then eventually, like even the most recalcitrant behaviorists realized, well, this isn't really working. We have to understand the organism. We have to understand what's going on inside. So that you had what was called the SOR. And then within behavioristic therapy, you went from behavioral principles to which were basically operant and classical conditioning. You went to eventually within psychotherapy, you went to the ABCs, affect, behavior, and cognition. So you went from a duality to even within behaviorism to a trilogy, to a trinity.
Yeah, triune model. Yeah,
triune model. Yeah. So yeah. It's, you know, I mean, even in the school of psychology, which set out to deny consciousness and to, you know, to discard it, we end up coming to not only to a model which eventually recognizes consciousness on some level, but conceives of it in terms of a triunity, which is very, very interesting. And as you say, it's just like such the Gurdjieff talks about that, and he says, you know, everywhere in the world we see that the world is under the rule of division. There's all these dichotomies and dualities which pervade all sorts of aspects of life. But what's missing is that people are third force blind, because everything, all of these things always involve a third force, which is sometimes given by the medium in which they occur, or which is often some sort of hidden dimension which people don't recognize and which they have to eventually come to get a more comprehensive explanation. And that's, like you say, like in modern physics, like with the recognition of the importance of information, we've gone from this matter and energy, so now there's this third force, and people are realizing, you know, like that basically you have to have this third force to explain things. Perfect.
Yeah, that there's information latent within space itself, because Gurdjieff said that third force, he said, is invisible to us.
To us, yeah.
And he says it's often within the medium, and the medium of exchange in the world is space itself. So it's like the information is invisible and latent within space. So...
Yeah.
Yeah, but going back, so it's so funny what you're saying. Like, you never see these critics of Blavatsky or Gurdjieff or other mystics. You don't see them deal with substantively with the concepts. You find them pick up on stories about people or how people were supposed to be rascals or say rascals or whatever, you know,
yeah.
They're picadillos or whatever,
yeah.
And people claim of Blavatsky that she was proved to be a fraud by the Society for Psychical Research, but even that was there, that was disputed. A lot of people, it came out later, there were counterclaims, and I don't know all the twists and turns of that, but my general comment was, is in a way, to me, myself, I don't care, because I just take The Secret Doctrine as a book. I don't care if Blavatsky stood on her head. I don't care. I just want to take her book and see what she says and evaluate the substance, the substantive basis of her concepts.
Yeah.
And it really doesn't matter whether Blavatsky had sexual relations with anyone, whether she had an inverted uterus, or what all the particular things people say about her.
And even that thing with the I was reading about that investigation is that, you know, there was the Coulombs were this couple that lived with her and supposedly participated in some of the frauds that she carried out. And, you know, on the strength of things, I think there's probably something to that. But I've also read that she had been targeted by Christians who were operating in India, who were jealous of her and had you know, wanted to get rid of her, basically, and so that was, you know, that was part of the deal, was that she had been targeted and that, you know,
yeah.
this may have been, it may not have been on the up and up, the investigation itself may have been tarnished, you know, but as you say, it doesn't matter. I mean, you know, there's statements that she plagiarized a lot of her work, but even if she plagiarized, she was a fantastic plagiarizer, because as like Manly Hall says, you know, Secret Doctrine is the magnum opus of modern literature, and Jocelyn Godwin, who's a scholar of esotericism, says that, you know, she knew more about the occult than anybody in modern times. And so, like you say, like, it doesn't really matter in the end. Like, you know, I don't care, like, you know, what the status of her uterus was either. I just care about what she says, you know.
Yeah.
Say,
yeah,
what,
exactly.
Yeah, you know?
And that's what you don't see in the debates on
yeah,
these subjects,
like,
of mysticism and science.
It's irrelevant, you know. It's like,
yeah.
You know, are we supposed to, you know, are we supposed to discount Stephen Hawking's ideas because, you know, like, he has, you know, trouble with his wife or something? You know, like, I mean, you know, that just doesn't make any sense.
So let's come back to what we've gotten off from something a little bit. I guess we've just been talking. About mysticism and science, I think, has been the theme for the day, what we're talking about, how sometimes, like, there are certain things in science which I now consider to be pseudo-scientific, like Darwinian evolutionary theory. Now, I'm not saying that there's nothing to Darwinian evolutionary theory, but the idea that evolution on this planet occurred because of random genetic mutations occurring to produce organisms which happen by chance to survive more advantageously. Like, in a way, I see that as a pseudo-scientific idea. It's not been substantiated. And there's different, you know, in psychology, the belief that the brain produces human consciousness. Well, that's an okay as a scientific hypothesis, but to assume that's been proven by science, I think, is fraudulent. So certain things in science, I think, are quack or pseudo-scientific, and where people end up taking their assumptions. It's like when Sperry says, you know, the functioning brain must produce consciousness. But that's not scientific. That's a leap of faith. Just like a religious person says that, well, God must be the origin of the human soul. I mean,
yeah.
You don't know that either.
or that the universe is created by a random fluctuation in the quantum vacuum. Nobody was there to observe it. So as Bernard Haich, the former editor of the Journal of Astrophysics, does, you know, the evidence for that proposition is zero.
Yeah, the evidence is for random universes is exactly zero. Yeah, it's a funny quote.
It's funny because it points to something that, you know, the more people sort of repeat things and it becomes part of the assumptive framework, and then it becomes a proposition, then it becomes a hard fact. But I mean, you have to be able to substantiate these things. It's like people make gross overgeneralizations based on partial evidence. Like, you know, in 1954, Stanley Miller, you know, sparked a concoction of ammonia and various other chemicals with electricity and you know, proteins were produced. So from the Miller-Urey experiment, people have concluded that life, you know, that there was a prebiotic soup on the planet and that lightning struck the planet and created life. And, you know, I mean, the experiment's really interesting, and it may be true, but that's a huge jump to say that because somebody did that in a petri dish that's how life arose on Earth, you know, like it's...
And then you could go further, like, in a way, it's like... Okay, so when he produces these precursors of kind of biological life, and he uses electricity, he flashes into the medium.
Light.
Well, I don't know. Is that the light or will of God
that kind of flashes
into the chaos and kind of it brings about life? And it reminds me of an example of this is when scientists were trying to culture different cells of different organs in the body. And they can grow kidney cells, and they can grow liver cells, and they can grow different cells in cultures. But they couldn't get heart cells to differentiate. And eventually, the only way they were able to get heart cells to regenerate or reproduce is by giving it zaps of electricity. Now, what's so interesting about that, because this kind of mystical view of the heart is suggesting that life comes into the heart from out of higher dimensions, that there's the SA node, the sinoarterial node, the pacemaker, that the life impulse is produced in the heart because of a higher dimensional metaphysics which underlies the heart. So something shocks the heart and it brings life into it. And that's what mystics say, is that the self connected to the heart initiates the heartbeat and helps the circulation of the blood, because the body is ensouled through the heartbeat and the breath and the blood. So there's another example, like here, you know, so the scientist uses his electrical zaps to kind of to help heart cells reform, but he doesn't consider, well, maybe there's something innate within the human being that essentially functions just like that electrical zap that we use in our scientific experiment. But they wouldn't consider it in that light. They would think, oh, well, this proves that it's just a mechanical thing. But really, it doesn't.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's what I would say about evolution, too, is that I think, you know, many of the observations that have been made scientifically and the explanations of them, I think, are accurate to a degree, but I don't think that they're comprehensive, and I don't think they explain everything. I think there's so much more beyond the chemistry that we understand and the naturalistic position that we maintain on these things. I don't think that these processes are entirely natural in the sense that people think they are, and I don't think that they're entirely random. It's funny. Like, I mean, randomness is a funny thing because, I mean, on some level, I think, you know, a lot of things are random on the level of our world orders, but I think that there are higher orders of reality which are informing those things where things are not random, that they're more coherent and there's more intentionality. And that's the thing, too, is that denial of purpose and intention in modern mm-hmm. science, that there's no intention or purpose in the universe, and there's no intention or purpose in anything having to do with life, which is, you know, again, that's a huge metaphysical assumption. It's an epistemological assumption, it's an ontological assumption, and it really, it has to be understood as an assumption. People state it as if it's a fact, and that's how you get guys like Dawkins writing stupid books like the God Delusion, because he's sanctifying his assumptive framework as somehow being a scientific fact, and then he's completely overgeneralizing it and you know, extrapolating from that perspective to deny the existence of God. I mean, he's so far from home in terms of, you know, what he knows and what he does not know that it's completely ridiculous. But that kind of thing is overgeneralizing and refusal to kind of examine people's own assumptive frameworks and to admit what they know and what they do not know is what I see as the main problem with so many of the things that are written about the, you know, the lack of proof for God and how science is doing away with God and, you know, how mm-hmm. God ruins everything. I think that's all ridiculous. I wanted to read a quote because I want to ask you a question. This is a great quote, and you've heard it before. It's from Tom Robbins, who wrote a book called Another Roadside Attraction, and he says that scientists have discovered and recorded, quote, laws, unquote, to which electricity, gravity, and magnetism adhere, but they have practically no understanding of what these forces are or why. It would seem there exists in the time-space grid a system of natural order, mathematics of energy, whose numbers are even more of a riddle to us than their progressions. It is this arithmetic of consciousness that more simple men call supernatural. It is in the realm of high mystery that certain men and women are destined to act out their lives. I love that quote because he says we discovered and recorded laws to which electricity, gravity, and magnetism adhere, but we have practically no understanding of what these things are or why. And again, like, you know, it's fine for science to say that those questions aren't relevant, but if you admit that, then you have to be very careful about what you extrapolate and generalize from your discoveries. It's like you know these things in a certain way, and that's all you can say about them. You know how to predict based on your observations, but you don't know what these things are or why.
It's interesting. In a way, it's how science, in a way, is descriptive.
Yes.
It can describe the phenomena, and even in mathematical ways, but it can't deal with the causes or
it's,
meaning.
It's descriptive and it's predictive, and that's the mm-hmm. beauty of science, is that, you know, you can take these descriptions and you can apply them practically, and you know that things will behave the same way because you've discovered these principles and laws that govern things. And so, but to go beyond that on an interpretative level is an entirely different thing, and the question of why is not a scientific question, but it is a question for people who want to set in order the facts of experience, which is Eddington's definition of true science. And that's why, in a way, it's like what Rene Weber says, is that in a way the mystic is more scientific than the scientist, because the mystic wants to not only unify all the knowledge and understanding that they have from their observations of the external world, but wants to unify themselves coherently with that knowledge, and it's something that the scientist doesn't want to do. The scientist wants to exclude himself entirely from his equations. He wants them to be out there mm-hmm. describing the world, but to be separate from himself. And even that position has now been, I mean, people have realized in 20th century physics that position isn't even tenable in a way. But
no.
What I was going to get to, the question I wanted to ask you, I was struck by this when I was flipping through the pages of Science, God, Science, and the Secret Doctrine the other day, was how Blavatsky's concept of full hat.
Oh, yeah.
And how that relates to electricity and gravity and magnetism. Very, very interesting idea, like what she says about that. So perhaps you could comment a little bit about that.
Yeah. Okay, so when In the cosmogenesis of the secret doctrine, before creation occurs and when everything is still absorbed in the absolute non-being, the seven luminous suns are said to be latent in the nothingness. When creation happens, the firstborn are said to be the seven luminous suns, or the Elohim, or the archangels, the seven archangels. So they're supposed first to be these divine beings, and then they're supposed to create these seven spiritual beings, which are a reflection of those on a denser level of a material plane. Now, the spiritual beings are divine intelligences, and they represent the mind of God. But in order for the mind to be impressed upon matter, the Blavatsky explains that Fohat is this cosmic principle. Fohat links spirit above to the matter below. So Fohat is the energetic principle that carries the intelligence of the spiritual intelligences, but carries out their errands, conveys their will. And he does, Fohat is cosmic electricity, of which Blavatsky says there are seven variations of Fohat. So it's like this vivifying or electrifying energy that manifests the intelligence of the spiritual beings into the material world below. So in mystical teachings, a human being is said to have body, soul, and spirit. Well, it's through Fohat that living beings are ensouled. So the body is ensouled by spirit. And it's Fohat is this cosmic messenger who manifests or actualizes the divine thoughts or divine intelligence. So that's how it's Blavatsky's triunity of the spirit is intelligence, Fohat is the energetic principle or the electrifying principle. Yeah, and Blavatsky says there are seven variations of Fohat, which suggests that there are seven laws of nature, all variations of one. Because Fohat is said first to be one and then to have seven suns. So just like there are seven spiritual intelligences above, then there are seven Fohats and then there are seven worlds below. So Fohat is one but also seven. So Fohat's a very interesting kind of character in Blavatsky's cosmology. But that's generally the principle. And in the stanzas of Zan, it says Fohat runs circular errands. So it's like you have zero-point centers which are spinning.
Yeah.
Like they're rotating. My analysis of Blavatsky, she says the universe is founded upon seven zero points, holes dug in space, she says. And these all are rotating. So what they're really like, these seven holes dug in space, are like mini black holes. They're information processors, in a sense. And information comes out of them, and they inform material processes. So Fohat is what connects spirit above to the matter below. So that's a little bit about Fohat. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a very interesting concept. As I say, when I was reading about it the other day, it's like that the idea is that she keeps talking about is that everything is septenary in the metaphysical dimensions, and Fohat is like this sort of fundamental, in a sense it's an octave, eh?
Yeah.
The fundamental sevenfoldness which sort of underlies and informs everything in the material world, not even the material world, but all of the dimensions below. Eh? Actually, that's an interesting question. Does she talk about the different world orders between the absolute and and the physical realm of the universe? Like, how does she break that down?
Well, partly what she says, she talks about a realm of primary creation and secondary creation. And the primary creation is the spiritual realm, the divine realm. But she says that's not really a realm of creation, because what the seven luminous suns, who are latent in non-being, when creation happens, they come forth. They're not really created. They're just unmanifested, and they are called forth. So they manifest. So, but she calls that the first realm of creation, or manifestation would be better. So that's like the divine realm. And then she talks about then it creates a realm in spirit. So that's a spiritual world. And then she has the spiritual world. And then you have the world of Fohat, which is the energetic world, which connects the spirit down into the material world. So I would say in Blavatsky, you have the same scheme as you have in Kabbalistic teachings. You have four world orders. In Kabbalah, it's called the world of emanation, creation, formation, and the world made.
Right.
So the world of emanation, see, when the lords of light manifest out of non-being, that's emanation. And emanations don't propagate through space limited by the speed of light. Emanations are like all pervasive. So those influences permeate all space. The world of emanation. And then you have the world of creation, which is a spiritual world. Like God creates heaven and the earth. So the spiritual world is the heaven world. And then the world below is the material world. And then you have the Fohat that links ensouls the material world. So Blavatsky has so you have the emanation, creation, the third world is the formation, and that's the world of Fohat, because Fohat is running the errands of these spiritual intelligences. So that's what gives rise to form, because Fohat impresses these divine thoughts into matter. So that's the world of formation, and then the final world is the material world, and that is the world made. So, yeah, I would say you have those, you know, I understand Blavatsky as basically similar to Kabbalistic teaching in having these four world orders. It's so beautiful. I think sometimes how beautiful, like, I think of Blavatsky's description of, like, the creation of the universe. And you just think, in a way, it's so beautiful. It's so symmetrical. Like, in a way, you begin with kind of nothingness. And then you have a point source of emergence out of the nothingness. And then it grows within without, like the budding of a lotus. And eventually, it begins to contract without within, back to a point, and back into the nothingness. So in a way, it's so beautiful. It's such a beautifully kind of symmetrical model of the nature of existence, that beings grow out of zero-point centers, they withdraw to them and back into the nothingness. And this can happen through different dimensions of existence. In a way, it's such a profound concept. Even today, it's relevant to science today.
Yeah, well, totally. I mean...
You know, now,
on an individual level too, I mean, that description could apply to, you know, the formation of a fertilized egg, and, you know, the manifestation of a human being, and then at the end the withdrawal of consciousness into these higher dimensions. I mean, it, you know, it's entirely consistent in a way, like with that perspective. It's interesting too that you know, in various people, science writers, in one of Sagan's books, he talks about, he says that, he's talking about kind of the New Age and mystical ideas that he's critical of, and that, he, you know, he says are based on misunderstandings and misrepresentations of things, and he's denying that, he's denying anything mystical about anything, and he says, you know, when people talk about UFOs and they talk about extraterrestrials and they talk about psychic phenomena, all these things, he says there's so many things in science that are, you know, he said these things would be really incredible if any of them were true, but he said there's so many things in science that we know that are true and to me, even more fascinating than the things that people in the lunatic fringe see as real. And he starts talking about all sorts of different ideas in science and everything.
Yeah, some of his examples were, there are two sides to the brain.
Yeah,
and chimpanzees learning language.
That's very, very good. Yeah, exactly. And he has this list. And then Richard Feynman says that, you know, how anybody could see it, the famous physicist says, how anybody could see anything interesting or meaningful in mysticism is beyond me. It seems like the worldview is so provincial. And Sagan picks that up, and he repeats that. He doesn't attribute it, but he uses that word provincial. And I'm thinking, do you guys actually know anything about mystical teachings? Apparently not, because there's, at the very least, you know, at the very least, even if it's all bullshit, even if it's all completely wrong, there's nothing provincial about it at all. There's absolutely nothing that isn't fascinating about it. It's entirely fascinating. The more you study it, the more you look at it, try to understand it, the more you realize it's incredibly complex. It's as complex as anything in modern physics or chemistry or any science. I mean, it's light years beyond anything that exists in modern psychology. It's anything but provincial. It's anything but simplistic or involving self-aggrandizement or wishful thinking. It's a depiction of reality, which is quite different from the modern temperament and the modern conventional thinking. But that doesn't mean that you can disparage it. If you actually knew anything about it, you wouldn't make these stupid comments. Hawking says the same thing. You know, I disapprove of mysticism. Well, what exactly are you disapproving of? That would be the question. If I could talk to Stephen Hawking, I'd ask him, when you say you disapprove of mysticism, what exactly do you disapprove in it? What do you understand it to be?
Yeah, I'd be very interesting to ask him. Yeah. It really would.
I'd love to hear what have you studied? What do you know about it? And then the other side of the coin is that you look at people like Fritjof Capra and Rupert Sheldrake and Brian Josephson and David Bohm and a variety of Charles Tart and, you know, all these Western scientists and psychologists Ram Dass, who've gone over to the other side and who have embraced the reality of mystical and esoteric teachings, or who have tried to examine them in a meaningful way. And it turns out that every one of these people has had a meaningful experience with the mystical or esoteric teaching or practice. Like they almost all have been involved in meditation. Sheldrake went and lived in India. I didn't realize that about him. He had lived in India and been in an ashram, and all of these guys actually have examined these ideas. You know, it's almost like a joke, but you know that about all 20th century acclaimed physicists, you know, become mystics in their old age. But I mean, several of them definitely were very interested in mystical ideas and you know, thought that there was something very important there. So I mean, it's astounding that these contemporary materialists like Sagan and Dawkins and Steven Weinberg have such disparaging reviews on mystical and esoteric teachings and reality of spiritual realities, yet, you know, there's so many people who have looked at this who have a scientific background, like Dawkins is entirely dismissive of anybody. He says they can't possibly think that way if they're scientific. But I mean, is that true, or is that just you expressing your prejudice? I'd say it's clearly him expressing his prejudice. But all of these other people have looked at these things and have seen, very interesting ideas. And I think the more you know about science, if you're open-minded to it, the more you'll see in these ideas. I think it's a huge advantage to have a scientific background.
And it's also interesting in that it points out the significance of having direct personal experiences.
Well, like, that's everything.
Like I was talking earlier about how we were both sharing like 40 years ago, like the different out-of-body experiences and discussion of that. And so we had direct experiences of it, which kind of, it's the accumulation of that, and at the same time as reading all this research on near-death experiences and ghosts and all the paranormal phenomena, and you kind of put it all together, and it's like there's an overwhelming mass of data that you can't just dismiss arbitrarily. And then there's Stevenson's work, like cases suggestive of reincarnation, fascinating evidences. And it's funny how the scientists, they just dismiss it all with the hop, a step, and the jump, kind of, and they think that's being scientific. They just dismiss it. They say, oh, it must be impossible. You know, I can't, how can consciousness exist apart from a brain? You know, and they just dismiss it out of hand. And in a way, they exemplify the actual worst in science. It's science not as being open-minded and having a skeptical and critical attitude, like I embrace that side of science,
yeah,
but not making dogmatic assumptions,
yeah,
and dismissing things because of your assumptions, and that becomes pseudoscientific. That's the element I saw in modern psychology when I, you know, was a professor, is like how, no, you know, there's all this evidence is that we're multidimensional beings and life is multidimensional, and no one even questions it. No one even thinks about it.
Yeah.
You know, I did that survey across Canada of 13 universities, and I wrote them a letter, and I said, like, I'm a student, and I'd like to study paranormal or psychical phenomena or mystical spiritual psychologies or investigations of the human consciousness. And I submitted this letter to 13 universities across Canada, and I researched their departments on the internet. And out of 600 professors across Canada, there was not one who investigated these areas. In a way, what I would say are the most important issues in psychology, like what is the ultimate nature of consciousness and self and issues like that, is there a spirit or soul, there was not one person who even considered those areas of study and discourse. So it's not like scientists are objective and value free. It's like they, you know, what's happened in the mainstream, they've kind of formed a dogma, and in a way there's almost been a persecution of people within the university system who wanted to explore those areas.
Well, I don't think, you know, there almost has been. There has been. Yeah.
Well, yeah, there has been. I mean, I remember looking back when I was at York.
You're one of them.
Yeah, I was one of them. And at the same time, I was facing in the mid-'80s the trouble at York University. And you had that other fellow, Howard Eisenberg, the psychiatrist from Toronto.
Yeah.
And he had been giving courses at U of T, and he put out that good book called Inner Spaces, trying to look at kind of science and the paranormal. And they kind of drove him out of U of T. And Ian Curry wrote what I considered an excellent book called You Cannot Die, A Century of Research on Death, and you know, he was at the University of Guelph, and even though he was just an adjunct professor, they kind of drove him out of that department, even though he was one of the most outstanding lecturers I'd ever heard entertaining. He was awarded a prize at York, and he came to York when I was there at Atkinson College and gave a brilliant talk on reincarnation, you know. So that the three of us were kind of all driven out of the Ontario university system, and you just see that it's very rare universities that even touch upon these areas. You know, I guess historically Duke had a department under Ryan of parapsychological studies, and I think there's another group at Princeton at the moment that study anomalous experiences. But generally, it's like Blavatsky said, in our day, scientists are even more self-opinionated than the clergy, you know, and that's kind of like what it is today, you know. The scientists are even more self-opinionated than the clergy.
Well, there's, you know, there's a, on the religious question, too, I mean, they're basically secular fundamentalists, you know, and that whole thing about value-free science is just, that's part of the professional PR job that they put out is completely, you know, not true. I mean, it's an ideal, but it's not lived up to. I mean, and anybody who's studied science and written about it intelligently knows that and has exposed that. It's like, it's completely ridiculous. It reminds me, like, in the mid-70s, William McGuire, who was a fairly prominent social psychologist, said that the bulk of social psychological research, and you know, and we're talking about thousands and thousands of studies done every year in various social psychology departments in North America and Europe, consisted of nothing but simple demonstrations of obvious truths. And really, you can apply that to almost all psychological research. I mean, it's complete. It's a complete waste of human intelligence and resources to do these, what we were talking about earlier, to focus on these little bits, studies of little bits of what it means to be human, psychological processes and functions, and then to try to extrapolate from that and to have the faith that if you do enough of these things inductively, you'll lead to an integrated and comprehensive perspective, a scientific psychology. It's completely ludicrous. I mean, because the main problem with psychology, and apparently this is true of a lot of biology from what I've read too, is that they don't study human beings. You know, they study bits of human beings and little tiny processes in human beings. And the more isolated and the more objective, quote unquote, things get, you know, the more scientific, quote unquote, they get, the more meaningless they get, because they're completely divorced from the context in which they have to make sense, which is what is a human being. It's interesting, I do. We've talked about this on previous programs, but what's the nature of the I experience? Like that's the big question in psychology. Nobody goes near it. You know? Nobody wants to touch it. Like, I mean, you and
yeah,
I.
Yeah, they don't even think in those.
They don't
terms.
Even think about it. It's like, no. You and I studied, you know, personality theory. I mean, you wrote some outstanding papers in personality theory. I taught theories of personality at the university level. Nobody talks about it.
No.
Completely absent from theorizing.
Yeah.
It's incredible when you think about it. Eh? Like, I mean, it really is. I find it highly amusing. And, you know, it's like Woody Allen once was asked about religion, and he said Jewish, but with an explanation. And that's the way I feel if somebody asked me, what's your degree? And
Hold on just a sec. He said, someone asked Woody Allen his religion, and he said
Jewish
with an explanation.
But with an explanation.
With an explanation.
Yeah, and that's the way I feel about my psychology degree. What's your degree in psychology? But with an explanation.
It's
like it's so fraudulent in a way. Like, I mean, it's funny because there's so many interesting things in the study of psychology, and especially in personality theory and abnormal psychology, but you realize that how divorced from reality so much of what passes as science is. The other day I just happened to be I was looking through my bookcase, and I came across Dean Radin's book, The Conscious Universe, and he does his, which deals with the whole body of there has been a lot of research done on psychic phenomena, and especially in North America, as you say, like in places like Duke, especially. But there has been quite a bit of research worldwide. Actually, it's not just North America.
Yeah,
and he talks about doing a meta-analysis of like a statistical analysis, which doesn't focus on a particular study, but focuses on aggregates of all of the studies done. And he provided, you know, he argues very convincingly, I think, that when you compare the evidence for various psychic phenomena through all the experiments done, it's much stronger than for many of the things that we take for granted. Like he uses the example of what is a, you know, what's the evidence that taking an aspirin is good for your heart? Well, when you look at it, the correlation between prevention of heart disease and taking an aspirin is so small, like it's infinitesimally small. It's very, very tiny. And in fact, in Great Britain, I think the studies have failed to confirm it there. Anyway, he points that, and then he gives statistics for psychic phenomena. I mean, where the odds are like a billion, gazillion, cassillion, you know, to one, and where the correlations are much, much stronger. And he points out like how completely misrepresented this research has been, and how people haven't looked at it appropriately. But the other thing that he talks about, which is so interesting, he's talking about the replicability of certain experiments in physics, and he points out that we kind of assume that because somebody discovers something in physics that, you know, in independent labs everywhere, people following the same experimental procedure are going to get the same results. That's like the professional myth of science, eh? But he points out that that's not true at all. Like, even for physical phenomena, like, you'll get like 56% replicability of the same experiment, and yet it'll be accepted as an established fact. And as when you really start to look at science in those terms, you realize that so much of what we take to be scientifically established, you know, maybe it isn't. It's much more equivocal than we assume. I was quite shocked when I reread that part of his book, a very interesting part of his book.
Yeah, Radin's work very valuable, how he does a meta-analysis, so he can kind of collapse across experimental situations. And like, as you say, the evidence is, like, in paranormal phenomena, often get up into millions to one against obtaining the results you did by chance, whereas in most standard psychology experiments, you know, all you need is a probability level of 0.05.
Right.
You know, and these experiments will get, well, you know, thousands of times in excess of that. And then you have multiple experiments yielding similar results. Yeah, it's more the zeitgeist in a way. It's like science, you know, there was that zeitgeist of kind of reductionistic and materialistic science. And I think that's beginning to change with new ideas about, like, information as third force. And you know, I think it's really important. The whole science of non-local effects is profoundly important. Like, Sheldrake's work is where he talks about morphogenic fields and how he had experimentation where they would run rats in a maze in, say, the States, for example, and train these rats up in this maze. And then if they ran the same experiment in, say, Australia, and the rats there learned the maze more quickly than had the original rats. And it's like the more rats that learned this maze, then the easier it is for other rats, not even genetically, you know, just independent rats, to learn the same maze. And he uses this type of research to show how there seems to be a morphogenic field, like, common to different species, so that in a way, at the mind level, they share certain experiences and learning. And it's fascinating, like, there's no other way of explaining many of his kinds of phenomena he shows.
You know, it's interesting about his work, too, is that that goes back to William McDougall at Harvard at the beginning of the 20th century observed that, you know, he talked about McDougall's work, eh? Like, I mean, this is not a recent development, but again, because of the zeitgeist, the materialist, reductionist, you know, perspective on things, everything that steps outside of that is shunted aside and not really examined. It's hard to get money to do any kind of research that is not conforming to the norm. Sheldrake's work is fascinating. I want to read you something. This is apropos of our discussion about the intellectual climate at universities. When you were at York University, James Alcock, I believe, was also on the faculty, and he's a psychologist who's been a debunker, quote-unquote, of psychic research and sciences, and he's on the committee for the scientific investigation for the claims of the paranormal, and this is from David Ray Griffin's book, The Reenchantment of Science. He says, James Alcock, a social psychologist, says that a, quote, spiritual science, unquote, which parapsychology is sometimes said to be, is a contradiction in terms. Quote, how can a science of the spirit exist given that science is by its very nature materialistic? That's from Alcock.
Oh, yeah.
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 So then, yeah, I go to...
That's an excellent quote.
Yeah, well, it gets better. It's actually
it
actually gets much better, because then you go to the footnote that accompanies that statement, and that's from that appears in Paul Kurtz's The Skeptic's Handbook of Parapsychology, and David Ray Griffin writes that interestingly enough, Alcock makes this his claim even though he realizes that a non-materialistic science is advocated by John Eccles, a Nobel Prize winner, and Karl Popper, the most influential philosopher of science of the 20th century. Also, he repeats the conventional idea that, quote, the path of science was laid down upon the foundation of materialism, unquote, even though he had reviewed recent writings of Eugene Clarin, Martin Rudwick, and others who show that this was not true, especially for Isaac Newton. Oh, that piker. So, you know, so even though he knows that what he's saying is not true, he says it anyways and uses that. I mean, it's like it's lies reinforcing lies reinforcing lies. You know, it's just a spiral of misrepresentations and lies and corner cutting and turning a blind eye to that which doesn't conform. It's like it's all the antithesis of what the scientific spirit really is, which is to question everything and to be open-minded and skeptical. And if you don't get the, you know, if things don't make sense in terms of what you observe, then you have to revise your interpretation of things. And that's what's so wrong with the whole the whole conventional materialist reductionist perspective. Materialism is dead as an explanation of things. It survives, but it's dead because it has no future. Like, there's no way that it's going to survive.
It's funny because, like, even in modern quantum theory, as quantum theory has evolved, it's not materialistic.
It isn't.
Well, itself, kind of,
or
like,
even
like materialism dissolved, you know, when you know the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, and then all the, you know, the evidences for non-local effects and the implications of in quantum theory about how elements are interrelated in higher dimensional phase space, and there's so much within science itself, like it's like. Eddington says that the more science advances, the more the universe looks like a great thought rather than a great machine. And that's kind of been the direction of quantum theory. So Alcock's kind of like going against the whole thrust of modern physics, really.
Yeah, and I actually discussed that. I mean, Rozak says, you know, even the concept of the field is... it's treated as something, but he says it's really as spectral as anything in religious teachings. You know, the concept of the field is it's endowed with this material reality that doesn't really possess it in order to legitimize it. But I mentioned in the Problem of God's Contracting Universe is that, you know, in Sagan's work, there's so much discussion of so many different aspects of science. He jumps around. He certainly touches on a number of topics, very interesting things in science. But what's really missing is that he never goes near the implications of the great physicists of the 20th century. Like, he never discusses Sir James Jeans or Sir Arthur Eddington or Heisenberg or any of these people and the implications of their work, because basically what they've all said is that the materialist perspective is a limited perspective and that it can't possibly explain everything. And he knows that, you know, but he just turns a blind eye to it. And that critique, as you say, in a way, like, the best argument against against the fundamentalist secularists scientists who talk about religious things is that they don't even really represent what science has found. Like, it's a completely different representation of what science has found.
Yeah, and most scientists wouldn't take such leaps of faith and have such dogma as they represent. Yeah,
yeah.
I think it's a misrepresentation of the scientific community.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I noticed we're coming.
Yeah, we've
just got a few minutes left. Well, you're gonna get a copy of God, Science, and the Secret Doctrine within the next couple of days. So over the next few shows, I'd like to try to go through that and really try to explain, and we'll both have it as a resource.
I was just gonna say that dovetails nicely with what I'm doing, because I'm trying to, you know, try to figure out what I want to take out of your work. And I know what I want to take out of the Heart Doctrine, but I'm not sure what I want to take out about this. But you touched on something that I was going to bring up much earlier, and we can discuss it in the next program, is that I was reading about non-locality in your work, and Nick Herbert's statement about how it just drives scientists crazy, that the idea of non-locality, and they don't want to talk about it. So I think we should pick up on that, because it's exactly what we were just talking about, is that if you really look at what science has discovered, then you have to go beyond the strict materialist perspective, and the reductionist perspective is shown to be like very limited in its application, and then you get into people like Bohm an entirely different way of trying to understand and interpret what modern physics has established. Very interesting.
Yeah.
And that dovetails again with the whole mystical and esoteric perspective on things, which is so interesting.
Yeah.
So,
we'll be back in 2 weeks, and we'll pick up on the studies of Madame Blavatsky in modern science. And what I like most about the Secret Doctrine, Jim, is how it goes back to the microcosm and the macrocosm, and the idea that when we study the principles of creation of the universe, in a way, the whole idea is these same principles are operative within us. That's what especially makes it profound. So this has been the Zero Point Radio Show. I'd like to thank BBS Radio. I encourage our listeners, go to zeropoint.ca and have the Heart Doctrine available. I've not been selling many books. I really see this as an important book. You can buy the Heart Doctrine through amazon.com. And we'll be back in 2 weeks with our further esoteric studies. Thank you all. Goodbye.